Class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Brian Mutiny. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. I'll tell you, I've recorded this episode about George Floyd a couple of times. I have struggled to articulate my ideas, I think. Obviously, this is something that is drastically emotional to me. And I have experienced bouts of confusion because of it. Mourning often occurs with confusion. I want to start today by saying something that has really been circulating in my mind. As I watched these photos, these contrasting photos of police officers kneeling with protesters, as I watched simultaneously these images of police officers beating protesters and just acting immorally, especially in New York City, some other large cities and places throughout the country, I asked myself, is that enough? I asked myself if that's enough. And I found myself saying, no, it's not enough. It's not. That cop, he took a knee. He did. The one who killed George Floyd. He took a knee right on that man's neck. How many police officers in the back of their mind are taking figurative knees, not in support of Colin Kaepernick, but in support of George Floyd? There was an image that came out the day before he was arrested, and it told me all I needed to know about the fraternal order in the benevolent association in that area, Minneapolis. There was an image it was at night, of these cops stacked 4, 5, 6, maybe more deep. I could only see so far in the dark. In their uniform, standing in front of that man's house, in lines to say, if you are going to come and get him, you are going to have to come through us. This man had been fired already. And they were protecting him. It told me all I needed to know. But as I struggled with this question, is it enough? I recounted how many benevolent associations, many police unions across the country released statements Many Fraternal Order chapters released statements criticizing Colin Kaepernick. I remember there's a there's a law enforcement industry few magazines that specifically target the law enforcement industry. And they literally had issues where you could read from various law enforcement officials across the country how horrific Colin Kaepernick was for kneeling. Geico changed its commercials that were being run during the NFL to include police officers. If I remember correctly, they used the term public servants or something like that. But it was pretty well understood. It came right after military personnel, so I knew exactly what they were referring to. They were referring to police officers who they put into the same category as military personnel. For a sport where I think it's 70% of the players are black, if the numbers I've seen recently are correct, you barely have 10% of the coaches. I don't even believe you have 10% of the coaches, head coaches, being black in the NFL. Geico made sure to put its name on commercials which said, we hate this black man for kneeling, and we support police officers. People forget about that. People forget about the benevolent society having issues, the benevolent associations and the fraternal orders having issues with black basketball players wearing I Can't Breathe shirts or Hands Up, Don't Shoot shirts. You remember that? They were quick to release statements about these Negroes not staying in their correct position very quickly. But I did a quick Google search, and I can only find one benevolent association that released a statement that said, this is incorrect, this should never have happened. What are you doing? Yeah, sure, police departments have done it, whatever. I don't care about that. Benevolent associations, fraternal orders, go deeper than the actual police departments. Fraternal orders include individuals who are out on the streets posing as ordinary citizens that are actually police officers. It includes people who have retired. Ahmed Arbery, anybody? It includes people who have retired, family members, boosters, companies that associate with them. It is a vast network to have a fraternal order or a benevolent association come out and say, this is incorrect. These are the chapter specifics. These are the chapter rules that this man broke, and this is why we do not stand with him. This is why we condemn him and think he should be charged not with third degree murder but with first degree, because after it was clear that that man was not moving, he still kept his knee on his throat. Benevolent associations should come out and condemn this man en masse. If they can't do that, then they're lying to you, ladies and gentlemen. They are lying to you. Lying to you. I don't care how many of them take off riot gear and march. I don't care about that. Because that means nothing. Anybody can do that. a murderer who intends to murder a whole lot of people can easily not murder people for a long time and just, you know, act like everything's good, and then suddenly one day walk in and start spraying bullets everywhere. That happens. Walking with a group of people don't mean that you support them. And in fact, we often forget about this part. Police departments train their officers to lie. We forget about this. Not only do they train their officers to lie, but they are told that it is preferable to lie in instances to keep up appearances than to tell the truth and break those instances of appearance. What do I mean? I mean, if they want you to believe something, they're going to lie to you to make sure that you believe it, even if it is not the truth. Them marching means nothing to me. Nothing to me. Not because I hate cops. You know, that's a narcissistic way of looking at it. Oh, you do it because you hate me. Plus, it tells you where their mind's at. Don't project onto me how your mind works. Just because you do it because you hate, don't mean I do it because I hate. That's the difference. All these benevolent associations and fraternal orders could come out and they could demonize Colin Kaepernick. They could demonize young children for kneeling during the pledge. Or during the national anthem, I mean. They could demonize these kids. They could demonize these people doing this. And yet now they can't release statements saying this man should be charged with first degree murder. He does not stand for what policing and law enforcement is supposed to stand for. They can't do that. Then they're lying to you. That's pure and simple. They're lying to you. But I want to go a little bit deeper than that, ladies and gentlemen, because I've heard a lot of people have discussions on whether or not this is these quote rebellions, these riots, whatever you care to call them, if they're effective. But there's a point that is often missed. It's not brought up. And it needs to be brought up because this answers the question 100%. Actually, I guess it doesn't really answer the question 100%. But what it does do is it colors. It colors the question. And make sure that you have, it makes sure that you have to consider this idea, this concept, this reality, before you can even entertain trying to answer that question. Are these things helpful? And that reality is this. We know, because the FBI wrote about it, we know there has been a sustained war executed against the black community since the 1960s. We know that. That's not even a question. That's not even a question. We know that it was decided during the Reagan administration to ship crack cocaine into the black community to disrupt its cultural patterns and its unification mechanisms. We know that. We know that in the heels of crack cocaine in being introduced into the community, we know, for some reason, gangster rap suddenly exploded. Where, yes, hating police for one thing, but we also forget that it encouraged people to sell drugs, to create a market for all them drugs being peddled into the black community. And then we know that just so happens during that same era, that same period where gangster rap was flourishing, what do you have? You have all these tough on crime laws, including the 1994 crime bill that was signed and started locking up black men and black women en masse. We know that. This constitutes literally, I mean, I didn't even talk about the COINTELPRO and the Black Desk programs. That last one we don't even talk about. That coincided, or not coincided, that preceded that. I didn't talk about the influx of heroin into the black communities in the late 1960s. I didn't talk about the fact that the DOD was caught sending young black men to fight on the front lines of the Vietnam War for one reason. They were adamant about this. They said, we want to send as many young black men to the front war of the Vietnam, to the front lines of the Vietnam War in order to kill as many as possible in order to take them out of the revolutionary and radical struggles at home. They said this. I ain't talk about that. There has been a war against the black community occurring for the last X amount of decades. And we aren't even considering that. We aren't even talking about that. Because along with that war, there has been something else that has been happening too. And this rarely ever gets covered, especially among black folks. We don't typically talk about this. We don't typically talk about this. At the same time that these people have been ravaging our community, destroying it, ripping it apart, you know what else they've been doing? They've been poaching some of our greatest minds. As they have created the chaos, they have sought to find the greatest minds in the black community and to attract them out of the black community to come into the suburbs, to come into their world, to then buoy their world. Oh, you don't want to be part of that chaos? That's fine. You're a good little Negro. Come and work for us. We don't want you as part of them over there anyway. We want you to come and work for us. Don't worry. You don't act black. You're one of the good ones. You don't act black. Don't worry. We like you because you don't act black. You're not one of them. You're one of us. Come on. It has been an assault on multiple fronts. And yet, we aren't even considering these things when we talk about whether or not these riots, these rebellions, are beneficial. We're not even talking about that. We're not even talking about why so many of our best and brightest minds are sitting in prison. Chris Hedges talks about this. Chris Hedges talks about this. I know, especially for many black folks, y'all may not know who he is. But Chris Hedges, who is he's an Ivy Leaguer, spent his time overseas. Father was he was a priest. He talks about the fact that he teaches in a jail. In that he meets smarter people in there sometimes than he meets on the outside. Think about that. Think about that. They have decimated our community. They have destroyed our community and put some of our greatest minds behind bars. While they have pointed to you and said it's your fault. This is something that we don't talk about. This is something that we don't consider. This war, this desire to tear apart the black community and to consume it. We don't think about it. And we don't think about it for many reasons. But one of the primary reasons we don't think about it is because we are encouraged not to think about it. They have rammed into our minds, where we used to have priorities that surrounded family, community, and what have you. They have rammed in place of that basketball, football, alcohol, partying, music, all this other junk that doesn't really amount to anything. They have replaced your culture with a demiculture. They've replaced your culture, black people, with a demiculture. It's starting to spread into the white community now, but for a long time, and you see this back in the 80s, they were already at work degrading our culture. And we did not realize it. We didn't realize when Jesse Jackson was protesting gangster rap that he wasn't protesting black people. I mean, it's too late now. But he wasn't protesting black people. He was protesting the sludge that was trying, that was being trained to infect the black mind and to poison our community. He foresaw that. He foresaw it. And yet, nobody heeded his warning, or very few did anyway. The devil, Satan, we all like to read the Bible. But how many of us understood the nature of Satan from the Bible? Satan was an angel who worked well with music. He was an artiste of musical instruments. And yet we ain't see it. We couldn't comprehend it. Well, 30 plus years later, we now have mumble rap. We now have something that is even more devastating to our intellect. But that's just the latest chapter in this war. I've seen a lot of European Americans marching with black folks. I've seen protests throughout the world, and that's awesome. I'm glad. Even though black people, it's time that we work on our liberation by ourselves, for ourselves, and deal with comrades, not allies, comrades. And I say comrades, not allies, because Europeans make horrible allies. They don't even treat themselves right when they're allies with each other. We need comrades. We need people that are going to be there for the long haul, that are going to be committed to changing their code of action in order to facilitate real change. That is a comrade. An ally, yeah, that's child stuff. You have allies when you're in preschool. And you realize this because, again, Donald Trump is showing you what the meaning of a white ally really is. So you want comrades that are going to bend themselves to the code of ethics that needs to be established in order to make life more meaningful and to inflate really justice in this world. But I've seen many people march in solidarity in order to protest George Floyd's death. And some are being smart. They're saying, look, I don't understand it. I can't understand it. But I think this is wrong. Well, I want to explain something that is not readily available or readily apparent, should I say, to a lot of people. And I think even to us black folks, we aren't perceiving correctly, the level of reincarnated trauma that is bubbling up to the surface. I really don't know if we understand. Now, in the black community, we typically don't talk about reincarnation. We don't talk about, you know, past lives, things like that. We only talk about genetical trauma. That's the whole post-traumatic slavery disorder book. But if you believe in reincarnation, if you understand that we have lived before, then we get that it's not just genetics that are quote triggered by events. Memories in your spirit and in your soul become activated, which then moves energy throughout your body and focuses your attention on something to an extent that logically seems overblown. You're overreacting to that. But when you understand that you're talking about generations of experiences that microcosmically compress themselves into one act or a series of actions, then you realize, oh, this is deeper than what I'm perceiving it as if I'm just looking at it through the lens of this life. This is something that this person has carried with them for 100 years, for hundreds of years. This is something that is a mark on their soul. I could not watch the entire George Floyd piece. I couldn't do it. I could not. And the people who could sit there and watch it, I don't know how. I couldn't do it because I could feel it. Every anguishing breath that he took, my soul quaked. I felt it from my toes to my crown. I felt it. I could feel that man dying. I could feel him struggling to hold on. When he started talking to his mother, I knew what that was about. And the only thing that I could hope that brought him some relief in those moments was his mother saying to him, "Baby, you're coming home, but you about to spark hell on this planet." Black people changed with that. The question is why? If you're black, I really want you to listen to this section here because this is for you. It doesn't matter to me if white people get it. It don't matter to me if natives get it or if Latinos get it. It doesn't matter. This is for you. Trayvon Martin was bad. Why? Because for the first time, we heard his anguishing cries. And because we are an audible people, we are an oral people, we could feel his pain. We can feel his fear. We wished to be there to save him. That was what made Trayvon Martin so horrible. I can't remember who it was, but there was this woman telling the story of a young man that was, I think it was her son, woke up crying. He was young. It's like 8 or 9. And he said, "Mama, I could see him. I could see Trayvon. I could see him being followed. I could see him being followed. I wanted to help him, but I couldn't." That captured, this obviously happened back in 2012, that captured the mood, the zeitgeist, the real thinking of most black Americans. There was a brother who was interviewed on another podcast that I used to listen to, 2016, and he talked about graduate students, this guy was a professor, coming into his office at college and breaking down in tears. Faculty members, older faculty members, coming in and breaking down in tears over Trayvon Martin. We heard the desperation, and we know that desperation, don't we? We have felt that desperation before. Let's go back. How many of you have read the book Uncle Tom's Cabin? This is something that every black person needs to pick up and read. We need to read Uncle Tom's Cabin again. We need to read it. Imagine 1820. You're desperately trying to escape from Georgia. And you're running, and you could hear the hounds, and you're breathing, and in your soul, you are crying out for help. You only know that you're crying out for help. You only know that you are yelling and begging and praying and hoping for help. And you're caught, and you are drugged back into slavery. They beat you to within an inch of your life. So if you think about doing it again, you will think about almost dying. That makes a mark on your soul, ladies and gentlemen. That makes a mark on your soul. A century later, less than in fact, you're living in a middle-class black community, even, let's not even go a century, let's say 50 years later, you're living in a budding black community, Reconstruction era. You have gotten together with other black folks who have just been freed, and you are building a community. It is beautiful, it is wonderful, you feel great. You go to sleep one night only to have your eyes jarred open by commotion. Klansmen had raided your community. They were killing people everywhere. Grabbing your family, you try to escape. You got your gun. To your horror, they kill your son. They kill your daughter. They kill your littlest. They maybe even kill your wife. Or your husband. And you're running. Sad. Frightened. Scared. Trying to get away. And you're shot. And you're laying there bleeding. Crying. Angry. Hurt. Crying out to God, why are you doing this to us? And that demon who just shot you rides over to you and shoots you in the back of the head. That makes a mark on your soul. We're going to go ahead another 50 years. Same thing. This time, you're in a middle-class black community flourishing. You've been part of a delegation that's been going around to other black communities, setting up chains of communication, supply chains. You're going to start moving over to Africa and South America soon to be able to get the things that your communities need to build themselves up. You're doing great. You go to sleep one night in your home, only to be awakened by a frantic knock on the door. It is the neighbor's kid. The outskirts of town, the Klan has started ravaging the community. You grab your gun. You tell your wife and your kids, get underneath the bed, hide, and you go to help. Do I need to tell you the end of this story, ladies and gentlemen? On your way, you realize they've penetrated more of the city than you know, than you thought, should I say? And you turn back on your horse to go back home. You grab your wife, your kids, and you start fleeing, grabbing a couple of neighbors on the way. This time you escape. This time you escape. But when you come back the next week, the place is burnt out. Over half of the residents, hundreds, maybe even over 1,000 people. I mean, they don't really keep records of these things. They have what are considered just absolutely impossible death tolls for some of these raids. 200 people, 20 people, 50 people. Please, please. These were genocidal raids. You had thousands of people dead, and you remembered that, and you broke. It was sad to see your house devastated. It was sad to see your neighbor's house devastated. But there were still bodies in many homes. Bodies. Friends, colleagues. You felt helpless. You felt helpless. Why? Because you ran. You felt guilt because you ran. Maybe you could have helped. Maybe you could have been the guy that broke the back of this terroristic group of demons who kept doing this to you. That puts a mark on your soul. And now we fast forward. Because, you know, you were crying to God that night, wondering, how could they do this? Why would you let them do this? Now we fast forward to 2012 when you heard that child crying on that recording, and all you could think of was those three times. I ain't even get to the really bad one when you were stolen from Africa. It broke your heart. And then there was Michael Brown. I don't mean to diminish Eric Gardner, but I'm going to skip him right now. Then there was Michael Brown. And the image of him with his hands up, he gave up, and yet he was still shot. How many people being chased by those slave patrols gave up, knew they were cornered, but they were killed anyway? How many people had to watch that? Friends who had run with other friends to escape, gave themselves up, were murdered to ensure that their friends, their other friends, could get away and could hopefully survive and gain their freedom. My father once told me a story when he was a young man. He was in his teenage years, and a friend of his was lynched. And the only reason my father was able to get away was because those white men were too interested in lynching that other black young man. And my father couldn't do anything he wanted to. But it was a losing proposition. If he went back to try to help his friend, he would have been right there along with him. You know how helpless that makes you feel? You know how devastatingly painful that is to think about your boy, the guy who was going to share life with you, being ripped away from you? And I'm sorry, ladies, I don't mean to exclude you. I'm a man. Okay, so I'm speaking here from that standpoint. I can only reflect on what women have told me to say that the bond between women is actually deeper because of the cultural resonances between women are deeper. They hold together the fabric of the community. So I'm sorry. That's why Sandra Bland messed with every black person so badly, because They finally had to admit with Sandra Bland that this was genocidal. That white people were just after black people to kill as many as possible. That's what many black folks had to finally come to the conclusion of. By the way, just a quick note about the word genocide. Realize that they didn't use the word genocide to describe stuff really en masse in the pop cultural way until a bunch of white-looking, supposedly non-white-looking, or excuse me, white-looking non-white people were killed en masse. When 6 million Jews were killed, it was genocide. When 4 million blacks were killed at the hands of white people, or 10 million Native Americans were killed at the hands of white people, this is just progress. Tamir Rice only, of course, obviously, Tamir Rice happened before Sandra Bland, but Tamir Rice really brought home the suggestion that this was genetic, or this was genocide. And then Sandra Bland really brought it home. So now today, how does this all explain George Floyd? Because with George Floyd, when I really started thinking about why is this impacting people, particularly black folks, the way that it is impacting them, I have to tell you, I came up with something very startling. An image flashed through my mind. A cold image. One night even, it shook me to my bones. You're in your home. A black family. You see a black family in their home. You're one of the members. Okay, it's a big black family, as we used to have back in the day. And they're enjoying themselves. Maybe sitting down for lunch, or sitting down for dinner. Sun has gone down. You know, people are talking about what's coming up tomorrow. Everything is good. When Granddad catches a glimpse of something. The spirits in his stomach start tussling. There's a glow on the edge of the street. And it doesn't look friendly. He suddenly looks and says, "Clan, clan, clan." The family tenses up. Where are they going? What are they going to do? Why are they around there? There's not many people on the street. So what house are they stopping at? To the utter dismay of the people in the home, they stop out front. Men with guns and dogs and lit lamps rush into the home, knocking down men. Some of the men grab guns and prepare to fight, but it is soon evident there's cops mixed in. So they know if they start shooting, it's going to be a massacre, and the cops are going to cover it up. They come in, they start knocking men around, showing whose boss, as it was said. And they grab the 16-year-old boy in the room. "Come here, boy. Oh, you thought you were going to be able to get away with it?" Ah, they hit him. Mother cries. Father said, "Leave him alone." He gets hit with the butt of a gun. "Oh, you thought you were going to be able to talk to Miss Susie like that? No, oh, we got something for you." They drag him out the house. Mother's crying, sister's crying. The men go chasing after him, only to have the cowardly police officers dispatch their little white posse to hold guns on the men as they load the 16-year-old into the back of the truck. The sheriff, who is the posse leader, turns around with his toothy smile, snake-like tongue. "Well, don't you worry, we'll get him back here nice and safe to you," he says. "Don't you worry." And then turns, climbs in one of the trucks, and they speed off into the night. The father wastes no time. He gathers the family and disperses them across the community, getting together a party to try to go and rescue that boy. But it's to no avail. He didn't go. They didn't take him to the jail. And when they inquire about where the sheriff is, nobody seems to know. The whole town seems to be covering for him. The son is never seen again. The father is devastated. The mother is devastated. But this is the way of the world. What was the son's transgression? What made, supposedly, those demons do what they did? Because that's what they are. You don't do those type of things and expect to be called human. You're demons when you do that. What made them do what they did was supposedly the young man had passed a compliment to Miss Susie. What had actually happened was the man was friendly with Susie, who was in her early 20s, and happened to be wearing a dress and thought the dress was nice, and his sister would like the dress and asked about where she had purchased the dress from, because his sister's birthday was coming up, and he wanted to get the dress for his sister for Easter. So Susie had passed along the information, and the young man said thank you and said, "It is a beautiful, it's a mighty beautiful dress you have on there, and I think my sister would indeed enjoy it." And Susie responded to something, and he said, "Well, it is a mighty fine dress that you have on there," and left. A young man who happened to be there with Susie, or in the same room as Susie, heard these compliments and thought that the two of them were a little bit too friendly. And thus started the problems, started the trouble. Susie, who was questioned about it, knew that the young man had no ill intentions, but decided that her virtue as a white woman was better, was better to remain, unstained. So she goes along with the narrative and says, "Yes, he was hitting on me. I told him not to, but he was hitting on me." And the ball began to roll from there. However, I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Rosewood. They made a cruddy TV show called Rosewood a few years back, and I was pissed. Go and see the movie Rosewood. Go and see the movie Rosewood. You want to know why this touches you, black folks, in the way that it touches you? That's why. Your soul's memory can't let it not touch you. Well, I am going to take a break here. This is going to be the end of this part. There will be a part two, trust me. I'm your brother, Brian Meredith. I'll see you on the next one.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio talk shows and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore and they pick up a gun.